It seems like the whole world is going mobile, and that includes the federal government. Agencies are using more and more apps for collaboration, productivity, you name it. But some apps increase the potential for exposing government data. To help you guard against these security risks, the National Institute of Standards and Technology is providing tips to the federal community for vetting third-party apps. Computer scientist Tom Karygiannis joins us to discuss those guidelines. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
All right, so what's the major problem that you're trying to address with this guide that's coming out?
So as you can see, when you're walking down the street, everybody's using a mobile app or a mobile phone, smartphone, and you know they're checking their email, using apps, and all these things.
I've bumped into quite a few people myself that way.
Right. I mean, there's some counties that have laws against walking across the street and being distracted while you're walking, not only driving, but just walking across the street. So clearly, anybody that's in the metro or you're driving and you peek over to the other driver next to you or just looking at the bus stop, everybody's using a mobile phone in some way or other. We started looking at this problem about 3 years ago when the military wanted to see how soldiers in a tactical environment could use a commercial off-the-shelf smartphone. And clearly, there were a lot of security issues just for the military applications. You want to know that if the device is lost or what apps are you using, what data are they collecting, who are they sharing that data with. And, of course, other agencies as well. It's not only DOD. Civilian agencies are using them as well. And the purpose of the guideline is before you use an app, what do I need to know about it to understand what security and privacy risks it might introduce?
So what are some of the top tips? In other words, I guess the first question would be how can you know about an app that you just download or that you're considering putting on your agency app store?
If you're a consumer, really the only thing you have to go by is the end user license agreement, which nobody reads. You can hope that the app store has done some testing, but their security requirements aren't as stringent as government security requirements. So, for example, if you're using any type of encryption to provide confidentiality of sensitive government information, you have a requirement to use certain cryptographic protocols. Clearly, if you're downloading Flappy Birds or something like that, they don't have that requirement. So government agencies have, I guess, a higher responsibility to protect either government-generated data they collect from citizens, you know, whether it's the Veterans Administration, CDC, you can imagine Social Security Administration. There's a lot of requirements for government agencies to protect their data. And since people are accessing data and creating data using these smartphones, we started looking into seeing what these apps do and provide ways for other government agencies to vet them themselves and decide whether or not these apps are acceptable for their own use.
Now, aside from reading the privacy statements and whatever documentation, which is usually pretty skimpy, that comes with those apps, what kind of tests can agencies, say the IT staff, do to see how these apps behave with respect to all the data on the phone?
So there are automated commercial tools that do static and dynamic analysis of apps. Basically, the static analysis is looking at the code itself, and then the dynamic analysis is looking at the behavior of the app once you've installed it and start using it. And there are automated techniques to evaluate both the static and dynamic properties of an app. But there are also other things. For example, a few years ago we noticed in app stores there were a lot of banking apps. And some of the banking apps were not created by the banks themselves, but it was just somebody that took a logo and put a well-known banking logo and said, okay, you know, start using your app. It makes your banking easier. And it was just collecting usernames and passwords from banking accounts. So given that there's hundreds of thousands of apps out there, not all of them suitable for government use, people want a way to understand what they do before their employees start using them.
So there's really two problems. One are malware. The apps are just parading as something that they're really not. But then there's also the behavior of legitimate apps that just do things for their own purposes or for consumer purposes that might compromise someone in an institutional or government-type setting.
Right. So there are weaknesses in the legitimate app itself. So there have been cases where, for example, cryptographic keying material is coded, hard-coded inside an app, and that's a programming or security practice that kind of shows a poor understanding of how to implement these protocols. There's fraudulent apps where it's not really a virus or a Trojan, but it's just collecting information or doing things that it's not letting the user be aware of. There's that type of fraud. There's in-app purchasing fraud. So we looked across the whole landscape just to see what kind of fraud and malware and activity that was migrating from the web onto the smartphone, and which of these were relevant for government agencies. And the new thing about the mobile phone is, unlike, you know, your desktop, these mobile devices, now you're carrying them with you all the time, and they have a number of physical sensors on there, whether it's an accelerometer, gyroscope, GPS, all kinds of Wi-Fi connections. So the implications are a bit broader when you're carrying this device with you all the time.
We're speaking with Tom Karygiannis, a computer scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And with respect to the tracking via location information, the Wi-Fi or the cellular functions, those radios that are on those phones, how much can that really tell about a person, and to what extent do you consider locational information that's constantly transmitted to be a security risk?
So it depends on the context. A lot of people now voluntarily check into these social media sites and, you know, take a picture of the sandwich they're eating at, and they're telling everybody what restaurant they're at. So within that context, people are there's kind of been a cultural shift where people are sharing a lot more information than we used to. You know, anywhere from selfies to restaurant reviews and the other social media. On the other hand, if you clearly, you know, what you'd have to think, what cases would a government employee not want their location disclosed? So maybe you're a diplomat overseas, or maybe you just don't. Maybe you're worried about a nation state following your activities. So in that case, you have to ask, so who's collecting my information? And it could either be the app that's selling your profile information. When you connect to a Wi-Fi hotspot, someone has your location information. And then for the most part, the carrier knows your location. So, you know, these may be more of interest to law enforcement, or, you know, if you I don't know the situation. You know, I'm sure for classified or diplomats or other occupations, they may be worried about somebody tracking their location. For the average person, you know, I don't think it's some Orwellian dystopia where, you know, the government's following every action you do, you know, in that sense. But if you have worries about that, and you don't want people tracking your location everywhere you are, then you should at least be aware of it.
Now, there are certain widely used apps that almost everybody uses, and they are certainly being used by the federal government. I'm thinking of things like Evernote or Yammer and things like that that are overlaid on other activities. Has NIST tested those? I mean, can one agency take a look at it and maybe publish those results for everybody?
So we've tested thousands of apps just to understand the state of practice and to discover our own vulnerabilities and to be able to produce the guidance. So we wanted to make sure that the guidance we're providing can be implemented. So we don't want to create a test that nobody can perform. We also have to consider how much this testing costs, because people, in some cases, they think the app is free, so it's not any testing or quality assurance isn't in their budget. So we had to get a feel for how that how much that would, what would be the level of effort. Now, apps like that, we've tested popular apps. We've gone through different sectors in the, you know, whether it's banking, finance, government-created apps, entertainment apps, social media apps. A lot of them, collect a lot of information, profile information. They can have access to your contact list. They have access to your telephone, SMS, your memory, all kinds of things on this device that, for the most part, the reputable ones are well-intentioned and aren't abusing it. But other apps, you really don't know what they're going to do with it unless you test it. So they can be collecting the information and then sending it to – they can sell the profile information to third-party advertisers. But, you know, clearly if you're a government agency and you're handling some kind of sensitive data, or your position is you're in the position to have access to data that other people don't, you want to be careful about what the apps are able to read on your device and what they're able to do with it.
And a couple of questions about the security on the devices themselves, the four-digit code. I guess that can be expanded to 8 digits. It would seem that would be going from 4 to 8 would really be a really important thing for everybody to do.
So that you're talking about passwords. Now there's a lot of new technologies being developed because the cell phone or smartphone has so many physical sensors. Some of them have biometrics on them where they can read your fingerprint. They can have, they can sort of, the authentication mechanism profile the user itself, and based on your movements, your daily routines, the way you access the device, can try to figure out if you're the right person using it. And all this has to do with, because these devices are so small, unlike your desktop, which is in your office, you're not going to go in the metro with your desktop, but you know, when you're traveling with your smartphone, whether you're at the airport in a taxi or going out to lunch, you know, people often lose them and forget them. So if somebody were to pick up the device, what could they do with it? If you don't have it password protected, they can look at your personal information. And if you're using apps that connect to your enterprise network, perhaps they could access data that's on the enterprise network now.
And my other question was with respect to that data on the enterprise network. A lot of, about a year ago, you heard, and before, you heard a lot about containerizing, so that the apps that were used for the government were in a logically separate drive, if you will, or memory area on the phone as the personal stuff. Is that proven to be an effective way to protect government data and also let people have fun with their smartphones?
Yeah, it's not a silver bullet, but it's definitely helps you mitigate many of the risks. So, and then as you noted, we started out with these standalone applications now on the smartphones, and now they're being integrated with the cloud. And so you could access data from the cloud, store data in the cloud. And that also, you know, that presents security opportunities to make the device more secure by not storing all this information on the device. So if you move it to the cloud, and you lose your device, and there's nothing on the device, that could be a good thing. On the other hand, by providing access to the cloud, what if somebody were to gain unauthorized access to data in the cloud? So there's two parts of that problem. So there's an opportunity, but also you have to manage the risk.
And getting back to the guide itself that NIST is publishing, what is the status of it? Is it finished? And when it is, how can people get a hold of it?
So typically the process is we have experts in-house that work on the document. So we had the domain expertise for about 2 years actually vetting apps, and we put our lessons learned into the document. Then we seek expert review, and these are people, whether they're in industry or government, to give us feedback before we make the document public. Now it's at the stage where we've posted it for public comment. So we have a 30-day period where anybody can read the document, submit comments as to whether they found any deficiencies, whether they have suggestions on how to improve the document. We take those all into consideration, and we try to reconcile the document with all the comments, and then at some point there's a final version that comes out in, you know, within a couple months, I guess.
All right. Tom Karygiannis is a computer scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Thanks for joining us with that update.
Thank you, Tom.